The serve, sliced, backhand return. Rafa with a backhand volley, and it's over. Game, set, and match. His third U.S. Open Men's Singles Championship.
Sloan from deep beyond the baseline plays a backhand. Keys a forehand. Sloan just hammering away. Now steps into a forehand. It hangs over. Forehand netted by Keys, and Sloan Stephens is the 2017 U.S. Open champion. A warm hug at the net between the two friends.
Here comes a big smile with Sloan. She can't believe it.
Welcome to Courtside, the official podcast of the U.S. Open. I'm Steve Flink, and our guest today needs no introduction. He's one of the most important and accomplished players in the history of the game. John McEnroe set himself apart as a left-hander, an artist, and a powerful personality who altered the game on many levels. He was ranked number one in the world 4 years in a row from 1981 through 1984. He won seven majors in singles and is regarded by most authorities as the greatest doubles player of all time. And this American icon won four U.S. Opens in his heyday in a golden era for the sport. John, thanks a lot for joining me on this podcast today. I'm looking forward to reviewing your career.
Well, I had a lot of great memories at the U.S. Open, so it'll be nice to relive a few of them.
Well, John, in this conversation, obviously we're going to get to go across the spectrum of your extraordinary U.S. Open career and the four titles. But before we get to your prime years, I just want to get you to briefly recount two things. One, your experience as a ball boy as a 12 and 13-year-old, and then the kind of heartbreaking experience you had in 76 in the qualifying when it looked like you'd won your match. Yeah. The umpire had actually called game, set, and match, and your opponent, Zan Gary, stood there for a long while, and eventually the referee, Anita Shukau, came out and awarded him the point, and you lost the match. So talk just briefly about the enjoyment or you got out of being a ball boy and then that heartbreaking loss in the qualifier.
Yeah, well, obviously I loved being a ball boy. It was close to the players that I sort of looked up to. My idol was Laver. I ball boyed for him. Bjorn Borg was coming around. You know, I got to be up close and personal there. My first match as a ball boy, I did a match with Raul Ramirez, and it was really hot, and I almost fainted. It was to the point where I went up, and in those days they had orange juice in these containers, so I went up on the changeover and got myself some orange juice, and I remember the two players looking at me like, what the hell is this ball boy doing? But I felt like if I didn't get some sugar in me, I was going to pass out. So I got a little bit of an inkling at that age, young age, of how tough it would be to, you know, get out there and, you know, much less stand there and play best of five sets. So that was, you know, one of my vivid memories as a ball boy. And as far as, you know, I actually played a doubles match with my coach, Tony Palafox, when I was 15. And then subsequently played a doubles when I was 16, played the qualifying, lost. So by the time I was 17 in 76, I felt like I was ready to maybe, because I was making some headway and was on the Junior Davis Cup team, and felt like maybe I was ready to make a move and get in. And I got to the match point against Gary, and I hit it's on clay courts. In those days, long, three and a half hour match, and hit a cross-court backhand that the umpire called a winner and said, game, set, and match, McEnroe. I was all excited. It was my first U.S. Open, and Gary was looking for a mark, like he thought maybe it was out. And there was guys on my team, Junior Davis Cup teammates, saying, just walk off the court. He's called the match for you. But I wanted the satisfaction of shaking his hand, so I was standing there waiting, and finally the umpire got off the chair and looked at the mark that Zan Gary had given, had showed him, and he said, if that's, you know, that ball is in, second time calls game, set, and match for me. So by this time, there was more clamoring on the side of the court and more of my teammates telling me just walk off. But I said, no, I wanted to shake this guy's hand. And lo and behold, this lady, Anita Shukau, who I guess was head of the referees at the time, head referee, was like 500 yards away and saw, I guess, some sort of commotion, because, you know, this was taking time, like over 5 minutes, I think, by that time. And then walked on the court and said, if that was the mark, the ball was out, and reversed the call. And I just was like totally frozen and like freaked, you know, couldn't believe what I was hearing, and sort of just fell apart, lost the match. And you know, went into the locker room, just broke down for about half hour, just was crying, like, uncontrollably. How could this happen? And I remember seeing the same guy, like, against Ross Case in the first round playing, and it was a similar situation late in the third set, close match, and the same type of thing where a call was made. And there was a hesitation. He was looking for the mark, almost like a exact replay of what happened with me, and I saw Case pick up his bags and walk off the court. And I thought, well, you know, that's a hard lesson learned. And, you know, I just vowed, I hoped that one day in the pros I would get a chance to play the guy. And I don't even remember if I did or not, or if it was a dream or if I did, but I knew that if I did, I was going to, you know, make him suffer.
Well, John, the next year you made Eddie Dibbs suffer a little bit. You beat him. He was the number 9 seed on the clay, very good clay court player, and that was a nice win. And eventually lost in the fourth round. But do you remember there was some kind of a shooting in the stands that night? And when you played Dibbs, were you aware of it at the time? Did you find out afterwards? That was a very odd incident.
After the first game, the umpire said to us as we were changing sides that someone had been shot in the stands. So Eddie says, I'm getting the hell out of here. And he just picked up his bags and started walking off the court. So I just figured I better follow him. You know, I got to go with him and get out of there as well. And we went to the clubhouse, that area on the side, not all the way back to the bigger building, that sort of awning.
Yeah.
And we were waiting under there for a couple minutes. And finally, someone came over to us, I think one of the referees, and said that it actually turned out that someone was in shock. They hadn't been shot. So we went back out on the court after about a 10-minute delay, and then we ended up playing the match, and it was a very close match that I pulled out, you know, in a very close 3-set match. And then we were told when we got to the press conference or after the match that, in fact, someone had been shot. Someone had fired a gun outside the stadium and it landed on some guy's leg. So I guess they lied to us to get us back on the court or thought it wasn't as serious as it should have been, but it was sort of a bizarre way to sort of be indoctrinated my first U.S. Open.
So, John, but it was a nice win to beat Dibbs, and you proved something there. And then by the next year, you break into the top 4 in the world, and you lost to Connors in the semis, but you were playing really well, you were closing in on it. So now we get to 79, and you beat Connors and your good friend Vitas Gerulaitis back-to-back at the end with pretty much impeccable performances. Assess that one for me. Did you believe going into the 79 Open that it was your time? And how did you feel about the way you closed out that tournament?
Yeah, I felt like it was my time. I got very fortunate. I got a couple retirements. Guys, you know, couldn't show up. So it was like everything fell my way, unlike, you know, what had happened before where it hadn't worked out. But I felt like I'd set myself up and paid my dues. The 78 U.S. Opens where I sort of developed that serve because I'd been having some issues with my lower back, and that turned out to be a great thing for me. Disguised it and had me going towards the net, and I felt like it was people couldn't read it, and I was it helped my back. So it was like a win-win-win, and so by the time I came back the next year, I felt like I was ready to do it, and I felt like I had outplayed Jimmy in the semis, and I was sort of, in a way, I was bummed that I was playing Vitas because he was someone who I looked up to quite a bit. And he was like the head honcho at the Port Washington Tennis Academy and in the New York area. And we were both from Queens. And we were getting sort of very mixed reviews from the crowd. You know, they seemed to be, I recall getting booed even at times, both of us really, because they were disappointed. Or so it seemed that Borg wasn't playing Connors in the final. And I remember thinking at the time, well, these two kids from Queens that both grew up, say, 15 minutes from Flushing Meadows, and we're not getting a whole lot of love here. So that was sort of disappointing in that respect. And then also beating Vitas, it felt like a little bit of some mixed emotions, even though I was ecstatic, obviously, to win my first major, but it sort of felt like it could have been, I don't know, it just didn't seem quite as rewarding as some of the others did later on. I mean, I guess in a way I expected to beat Vitas at that point, and it didn't feel that great to beat him. But, you know, the sign of the person he was is, to me in a way, was afterwards. He said, what are you doing later? You know, I figured the last person he'd want to be with is me. And he ended up taking me out, and I figured wherever he's going is a whole lot better than wherever I'd be going.
Well, did you feel? I remember thinking at the time you really peaked for an early career peak. It seemed to me that was it. You, as you said, you'd had some interesting experiences along the way with the defaults. You also had the Nastassi commotion with Frank Hammond
right.
in the chair as well that year. So a lot of strange things happened, but it felt like it all came together. Those last two matches.
Yeah, that's where I played the best tennis in my career, basically back to back. I mean, I was starting to get my confidence. I'd beaten Bjorn Borg, a little less than a year before. I'd won the Masters from match points down against Arthur Ashe, and had beaten Connors the first time. I had beaten Borg and Connors in an event in Dallas, which was a big event at the time. So getting to the Open, I felt like I was ready. I was my game was developing, the attacking game. More courts were, and tournaments were being played on hard courts, which was more to my liking. As I got older, because originally my best results, the first U.S. Open I played was on clay, and my best results were on clay. But then subsequently, when I went to college and started seeing that they were going more towards hard courts, I tried to develop more of an attacking game, which was more of my sort of personality and style, so it fit in well. And it was the ultimate to play Connors, because he was the guy that I sort of measured myself against in terms of effort, in terms of will. And, what I was capable of doing with the serve and volley, because he was the best returner at the time. So I felt like I had learned a bit from the previous year. I lost to him in the semis. And then that next year I was ready, and I played really some of the best I'd ever played. And with Vitas as well, because Vitas was a great athlete. He had beaten Tanner, who had beaten Borg, so he was a lot of confidence. And obviously he wanted to win it too. So, that was, I think I rose to the occasion.
So, John, now we jump to 1980, and obviously that was the year you had the epic final round loss to Borg at Wimbledon, featuring that remarkable 18-16 tiebreak. And now you come to New York, and you beat Lendl in four sets, and then Connors 7-6 in the fifth, and finally Borg in five. To me, that, as an observer, someone who followed your career closely, that might have been your greatest Open, considering what you did down the stretch there. And against Connors, at one stage you lost 11 games in a row after winning the first set and leading 5-4 in the second. So he went up a break in the fourth, leading 2-1, and it didn't look very good for you then. Talk about that. Put that Open in perspective. Do you agree? Looking back, was that your greatest Open, defending the title and doing it in that fashion?
Yeah, I think it was. Just that four-day period, playing those tennis greats and having to do it 4 days in a row because I played doubles on the Friday and went, played a five-set doubles match. So it wasn't a whole lot of time to rest. I played Lendl, I believe it was a Thursday night. It was one of the last night matches, quarterfinal matches. And that was a tight four-set match. And the Connors one was a war. And it was, like you said, it was a roller coaster. And he was a master at getting the crowd behind him, which, obviously drove me crazy.
So how did you manage, John? Those games, that he's sweeping 11 games in a row. The second set disappears. The third's gone at love. You're down a break in the fourth. That took a lot of resilience. And I'm sure you were feeling frustration and anger and almost bewilderment. So how did you manage to work your way out of that crisis?
Well, I made some sort of rookie mistakes because I had set point to go up two sets to love, and then when I lost that, I started thinking about it too much. And then he's the guy that once he gets on a roll and gets the crowd behind him, he was tough to stop. And so I let it, get to me a little bit. And so the next thing I know, I'm getting blanked in the third set. And obviously, the last thing you want to do is to get broken the first game of the four set when you just lost six love and had set point to go up two sets to love. And that's exactly what I did. But one thing I learned from Connors, or among others, is that you just can't give up. And you got to, especially, playing in New York and especially at the U.S. Open. And I couldn't believe the position I was in, that this had slipped this badly. But it would have been absolutely unacceptable to me if I had not tried to find another gear and dug deeper, because I had learned just losing to Borg when he did that to me at Wimbledon when I won the tiebreak and he found another gear in the fifth set. And I'd seen enough of these guys, the Connors, Borg, what they were capable of, that I knew I had to find another level. And I was fortunate that I was. And then I ended up you know, choking and surfer in the match in the fifth set. And well, lost
that. That's what I was going to say. He played a great game, and obviously you're being hard on yourself, and whatever the reasons were, you didn't serve it out. So how did, then you still managed to have the poise to get through the fifth set breaker?
Well, you know, that's one of the most emotional matches I ever played, to go to a tie. I mean, to me, there should be a tiebreaker in the fifth set at all the majors, and I would point to matches like that in terms of the excitement and the climax of a match where that goes on for 4 hours or more in some cases, and how that transpired and how much of a roller coaster it was for both of us. And I think for the crowd, it ends up being much better. And so to come all the way back and then blow my serve when I'm serving for the match, I mean, I wasn't assuming anything. And certainly the way Connors returned, I knew I had to be on my toes, but he did play a great game. And the next thing I knew, here we are. You know, it all comes down to a tiebreaker. So fortunately, you know, tiebreakers are, you flip a coin, but sometimes, you know, things happen that you don't expect, you know, a couple errors here and there. And the next thing you know, it's 6-3 or something, and you've got 3 match points. So somehow, some way, I was able to sort of just hang in there and be able to get through.
So, John, then the next day against Borg, he served for the first set a couple of times. He didn't close it out. You won that in a tiebreak. And then he seemed to kind of give up in the second, and you won that very easily. And yet he came back and won hard-fought third and fourth sets. So we go into the fifth, and my memory is that at 3-all in the fifth, you hit a backhand approach. It was called in, and Borg was very upset by he wanted that ball called out, and he stood there for quite a while looking at the linesman, and it seemed to affect him. He served a few doubles, and you broke him, and then you went on to win 6-4 in the fifth. Do you remember that moment? Were you aware of him seemingly perturbed for a change?
Well, him going crazy would be just stopping and looking at someone.
Yeah.
It wasn't like he said anything.
Right.
You know, he just sort of just waited for someone to do something, because it'd be so outrageous that he'd even look at an umpire or a linesman that people would immediately sort of get uptight and change their call, which, you know, I felt a few times when I played him. I felt like I was like, oh, my God, I'm acting so bad that I'm even making him do something, which, you know, was not one of my prouder moments. But in this case, I think it was more the case of him wanting it so bad because he hadn't won an Open, and sensing that he could do it, because he sensed, I think, that I was starting to fatigue a little, and that he
was. Were you?
Well, I was a little bit, because I just, you know, as I said, I had played Lendl Thursday, and Friday I'd played doubles. Saturday I'd played that marathon match with Connors, and here I was against, you know, who I consider to be the fittest guy in tour, you know, sort of the Nadal of the tour, you know, in having blown, you know, a 2-sets-to-love lead and be tight in the fifth set. So I felt like I had to prove something to myself, obviously, because I had gone away a little bit. I gotten tired at Wimbledon. I had to play Connors the day before there, and it caught up to me when I lost to him 8-6 in the fifth. So I wanted to show that I had the ability to sort of hang in there and try to get it done. And it also helped, I must add, that for me at least, there was a tiebreaker. So at least I knew it wasn't going to go maybe even longer than that. So from that standpoint, it helped a little bit. And I sensed that he was, you know, feeling pressure because he wanted to win it. And so I knew that it wasn't over yet. And so that allowed me to sort of, you know, seize that edge that I needed to get that break and be able to serve it out.
So, John, that was a spectacular achievement. But in 81, let's move on to 81, and now you're the top seed, and you had won Wimbledon for the first time that year. So you came into the Open, I assume, pretty confident, and you playing Bjorn again in the finals, and obviously you recollect that it's a set all, but you're down 4-2 in the third, and then you hold, and then you played what was probably one of the single most magical games of your career in a big match in a monumental situation like that, with a couple of topspin, brilliant topspin lobs and a couple of devastating passing shots, and came all the way back to win. Talk about that one.
Well, I was in the midst of another, what I thought could be like sort of an epic match, and obviously a very meaningful match for both of us. And I assumed, having been so close a year before that he was going to try to intensify his efforts to win this once and for all, the U.S. Open. I mean, he'd been in, this was his, I believe, his fourth final by this time. So I knew that he was going to come out ready to play. I had just beaten him in a close match and finally won Wimbledon. So I felt that was all the more reason that he'd have something to prove. And so I wasn't surprised that it was a close match and it was a set all. And then I was obviously disappointed that I got down the break, but he was playing well. And I did play a great game, but it was a game, you know. So I thought, okay, I'm back, you know, back on serve, but this thing isn't over by any means. But I felt like it was like someone let the air out of the balloon. You know, I felt right away that, like, I don't know what happened to him, but it was all of a sudden like he was a different player. And I don't know if he, what, you know, you'd have to ask him. He gave in. He just sort of tapped out. But I could feel it right away that he was, like, allowing me to sort of just take over. And I was, like, opening the door, and I was like, thank you very much, you know, and just, like, barge through it and take the set 6-4 and win pretty handily, like 6-2 in the fourth. And it was almost like by the end of it, he didn't even want to be out in the court, you know. And I felt, in a way, I was felt really amazed, in a way, that that he would – that happened. I never saw anything like that when we played, and very rarely did I – see him on the court with that type of attitude. And I remember shaking his hand, and he picked up his bags and he walked off the court and left the stadium before the ceremony took place. And I was like, oh my God, the guy just walked off the court and left before the ceremony. They would have arrested me if I had done that. And so, you know, and little did I know at that time that he'd never play another major. You know, to me, that was, you know, even a bigger disappointment than seeing that, was to see my great rival, my greatest rival, that and some incredible history that we have, to have it cut short like that, you know, was really, turned out to be sort of, that was really an unbelievably bizarre day.
So did you think that he just got, it seemed to get it in his head that you had surpassed him? I mean, and you've talked about this at different times through the years, that, but couldn't your rivalry have continued to flourish and gone back and forth? Did you think Bjorn got too discouraged?
Yeah, I mean, this is, you know, I'm not Sigmund Freud, but and yeah, as you can imagine, I've been asked these questions over the years, and I'm sure he has, and I'm not sure he knows or I know exactly what it is. I think it's like a combination of things. Bjorn was someone, he used to tell me, it doesn't matter if you're number two or number 100, you know, all that matters is you're number one. And so, like, I would think, well, hey, if you're two in the world, there's only one person better than you. So that seems pretty good, even though you'd like to be number one. And he was like, it doesn't matter. So to me, perhaps part of it was that he felt like at that stage, I think that was the third time in a row I beat him at the 1981 U.S. Open, that, and but that just leveled our career head-to-head at 7-7, I thought we'd play another 20, 30 times. And so I was amazed that, you know, things change. People get hurt. You know, things happen. You know, all types of things can happen that could allow the other person to take a step and you can and improve themselves. So the other guy gets bored. Or there's 100 things. So I was amazed that that he decided at that stage that he would just walk away from it rather than sort of regroup. As a matter of fact, I tried to get him to regroup, and I think it affected it not all. I'm sure it affected him, obviously, in his life, but it affected a lot of people, including myself, even sort of moving forward for a while on in my career. I was kept waiting for him to come back.
Exactly, because the next year, as it turned out, John, you know, you lost that very hard-fought Wimbledon final to Connors, Lendl Beach in the Open semis. You stayed number one, but conceivably Bjorn could have been right there in the mix with you.
Yeah, well, that's exactly right. And, you know, I felt like I got deflated. And, you know, matches that I felt like I should have won. Now, I mean, it's great, and I'm very proud of the fact that I won three Opens, and obviously Lendl's an incredible champion, but I felt like I was still in position to do damage and win those things, you know, and I should have won Wimbledon, and I was 3 points away, and you know, at the Open, I felt like Lendl and I was another, obviously a guy that I played in the juniors and we knew each other and we knew that we were going to play a lot. But, you know, that was certainly a match that I could have won. But, you know, then again, I didn't, but I think part of it to me was sort of just coming to grips with that. So it took me a while. It took me honestly, it took me the better part of a year and a half, 2 years, where I was sort of accepted the fact that he wasn't coming back.
So, John, to briefly go back to 81 and just the achievement of winning three in a row. Nobody had done that at the U.S. Championships or U.S. Open since Tilden in the 20s, and I know you were told that at the time. How significant was that in your mind?
Well, I think that it was an extremely exciting time to be part of the sport. These guys, the Labors and the Rosewalls and the Aussies and some of the other Americans, like Arthur when he won the first Open, and Stan Smith, what he stood for, you know, they paved the way. But then there was Borg and Connors and Vitas and Vilas and these other guys. It seemed like there was a lot of excitement and personality in the game, and I was very proud to be part of that. And I sort of compare myself in a way to Djokovic with Nadal and Federer. You know, I was trying to get the same level of respect they were getting, just like he has tried to do over the years. And so I took that as a great achievement that I was able to sort of, you know, I felt like reach their level, or at least close to their level, and feel like I'd be thought of in the same breath. And I backed it up, in a place where it was very chaotic, but sort of comfortable for me in a way, playing in New York. I mean, you mentioned the Stasi mess. That was like a near riot. People were always sort of, it was much, much louder generally in the stands, and something that actually freaked a lot of players out. But for me, having grown up in New York and sort of understanding it better, I was able to, even though there were people getting on me and, you know, yelling at me and stuff, and people were taken aback when I'd say something back to them, I felt like it was an extremely exciting place to play. And so I loved playing there. And so it was, to me, it was incredible that I couldn't believe that I was able to win it three times in a row. So that was, you know, that's certainly one of my proudest achievements, without a doubt.
So, John, your next title run was in 1984. It was one of the great seasons anybody has celebrated in the modern tennis, winning 82 out of 85 matches. And obviously, you lost a heartbreaker in the French final to Lendl, but you won Wimbledon with one of your signature performances against Connors. And you come to the Open, and once again, you have an epic with Jimmy on the Super Saturday. Talk briefly about that one first and compare it to 1980. Was it a higher quality match? You went five sets again, this time 6-3 in the fifth for you, deep into the evening, past 11 o'clock. How would you rate that one versus 80 in your mind?
Well, that's a tough one. I think that I was a better player. I think Jimmy, you know, obviously four more years had gone by. So, I mean, he was six and a half years older than me. So I sort of felt like maybe his best was behind him. But I also knew that he was the greatest competitor that I had ever played against on the court. And he proved that. You know, and he was, as I said earlier, he was a master at using the crowd to his advantage. I mean, he's a guy from St. Louis that convinced everyone he was a New Yorker when he's playing a New Yorker. So I'm like, this guy knows what he's doing. And that would drive me crazy. But I knew that he would sort of use every trick in his book. Plus, he was playing well. I don't know if he'd say he's better than he was in 80, but he was certainly not far away. And I think in a lot of ways, it was a higher quality match. But
so, John, he'd come off that shellacking from you at Wimbledon, and yet he broke you seven times in the five sets at the Open. You still won. What was the key in the end to your prevailing?
Well, the key in the end is that, you know, I was able to sort of compete as hard as, you know, as hard as he does and as hard as he did. That's the key, because you have to match his intensity. And I felt like, you know, I was a heavy favorite, obviously, or heavier favorite than I'd been against him, because I'd had this great year and I'd only lost one match. Or I'd actually lost the second match right before the Open, but that was almost like in a way to get ready for the Open, because it was the week before, and I wasn't really feeling like I needed to be there. Not that Vijay didn't play well, but it wasn't a performance that I felt like, oh, I'm worried about it, because I felt like my game was in good shape, and I was playing well, and I knew he had to play well to stick with me. And so he did, you know, and I was impressed, and, you know, he was hitting the ball clean. I'm not surprised that he was able to break me, because he was a great returner. But I knew I'd have chances when I played against his serve, too. I mean, his serve wasn't the biggest part of his game, and I'd be in those games. And I had to use, you know, my quickness to advantage, you know. We didn't realize that we'd be out there that late or it'd take that long. But, you know, finally when he started going around and getting the crowd into it and pumping himself up, I knew I had my hands full, but I just couldn't let it go at that stage. I just couldn't lose to him. I had to beat him in the fifth set because the crowd was getting into a frenzy, and I just luckily in that particular case, I was able to use that as motivation.
So, John, that ended so late, and you came back and played a pretty impeccable match against Lendl, who had also gone five in his semi with Pat Cash. How did you feel about that performance against Yvonne, given that he had come back from two sets down to beat you at the French Open earlier in the year?
Well, obviously, I felt like I had something to prove, but at the same time, I was concerned because there was no day off. You know, I finished that match about 11:20, and I believe in somewhere in that neighborhood, and had to come back and play at 4 o'clock. And I felt like I needed a little more time than that to recover. But I also realized he had played the 7-6 and the fifth with Cash. And I remember walking into the locker room and I saw him. When I saw he was in the training room and he was trying to stretch. And it looked like he could barely get past his knees. And I go, he's even worse than I am. stiffer than I am, because, you know, honestly, I think that's, thankfully, after 35, 40 years, they made the decision to give the players a day of rest, because I feel like that was too much to ask of the players. We weren't able to play up to our ability at times because there's just no time to sort of let the body recover. So in that particular case, and even the next year when I lost to him in the final, I felt like a fair part of it was because of what we had endured getting there. And so luckily, you know, my level was so high that I saw, you know, how stiff he was, and I knew how stiff I was, but I was able to sort of motivate and psych myself up into, if you can just play at that level you've been playing at for 2 hours, you can get it done in that period of time. You can beat him before it would become a physical contest, and maybe he'd get that second win like he did at the French, and that's what happened.
So, John, then you alluded to the next year, and you had a bruising five-setter with Wielander in incredible heat in the semis, and I know he mentioned to me in one of these other podcasts that you had called him and felt like that match had just taken too much out of you heading into the Lendl finals. But you did start well against Yvonne, and you had 5-2 and a set point on his serve, and he came back to beat you 7-6, 6-3, 6-4. Was that because he was in the zone, or was it because you were so debilitated?
Well, I saw that his game plan was to sort of pretty much just hit every ball as hard as he could. And that was sort of the way that maybe some of the bigger guys would end up making an impact on me. But I saw what was coming, but I knew physically if I was up to it, I could handle it. But if I wasn't, that could be problematic if he got hot like he did. And if you recall, Connors, I believe, had sprained his ankle. And the match between Connors and Lendl in the semis was very one-sided and very quick. And so he had a lot more left in the tank. Plus, he had sort of, you know, worked extremely hard and tried to get himself to another level of fitness, maybe because of what happened the year before. So it was sort of unfortunate circumstances that I had to go out in the heat and play Wielander. And it turned out that his match with Connors was like an hour and a half and was never really a match because Jimmy was his ankle was bothering him. And you know, what I remember from that match is vividly is that I, you know, got there late because there was I remember this is the one day in my career where it was raining and I prayed to someone up above that if I just get that one day I would beat him in the final again. But my body was like so sort of beat up from that match against Mats, and I just felt like I didn't have much in the tank, and it was raining most of the day, and I remember watching the New York Giant football game, and all of a sudden at the Meadowlands, I saw these blue skies, and I'm like, oh my God, it's clearing up, and I didn't get to the courts for that match to about, I would say like a half hour before the match, which is sort of funny, because now I see, you know, and in the locker room all the time, I see Nadal's there like 6 hours before he plays. So I'm like, what the hell was I thinking? But, you know, I got there, and then I really felt like unprepared, but I got off to like a good start, really good start. I got up 5-2, and then I remembered vividly, I got up off the changeover, and I started to walk to the baseline to get ready to return, and I looked back at the chair, and I saw my body on the chair. And I'm like, oh, my God, my body's still there, and my like soul is walking. And I felt like everything, ounce of energy I had, just left me at 5-2 in the first set. And it, from that point on, everything that I was getting to and was getting to and had been getting to for years, all of a sudden, I couldn't react. And the next thing I knew, I lost 7-6, 3-4.
So, John, then at the end of that season, you decided you needed that six-month hiatus after the Masters. In retrospect, was you were still number two. Was it a mistake, or was it something you just had to do?
Well, you know, I felt like the plan was that I'd gone very hard on the tour for about 8 years, and I wanted to sort of regroup in a way and sort of be able to appreciate all these great moments I had instead of sort of feeling like they were happening so fast that I wasn't able to appreciate them or that I was on to the next thing. So, and at the time, my ex-wife was about to have our first son, you know, in May of 1986. So I felt like this was an opportune time to sort of regroup, reassess, change some of, you know, my training, what I was doing in training, and trying to get stronger. And obviously, as you're aware, people listening, that the racket technology was really starting to sort of go into the next gear. And so there felt like, look, we got to get some stronger, or get some more power, you know, a combination of things. I wasn't, you know, I was having some issues with my hip, you know, so I felt like it was the opportune time to regroup. Now, I didn't, if you said to me after the fact, well, you're not going to be as good a player, you'll never be as good as you were when you stopped, I wouldn't have done it. But if you look at, like, say, what Roger Federer did, obviously, fast-forwarding, and it's situations are different, and you can see how tough it is with some of the other players trying to come back from injuries. He did something miraculous. He's been able to arguably be as good or better in a way. I had the intention of becoming better. It didn't work that way. You know, everything I tried, whether it's weights, yoga, this, that, the other thing, not playing doubles, playing, training more off court, training more on the court, whatever it was, it didn't work. So you look back and go, why did you do that? But I think at the time I felt I did it for the right reasons.
So, John, then you I appreciate that's a good assessment. Then you struggled in the late 80s, obviously, but in 90, you got to your last semi, lost to Pete Sampras in four sets. How gratifying was that at that stage of your career to be back around there, be in the penultimate round of the U.S. Open and playing that well again and giving Pete a run for his money?
Well, honestly, I felt like I should have been there earlier. I was disappointed that the way things transpired. I was extremely disappointed that I had a first-round loss, my only one, when I came back, and I wasn't ready to play. I realized I shouldn't have played. And the following year, my second son was going to be born, so mentally I wasn't there. Then I lose to a guy I ended up winning the doubles with at the U.S. Open. If you can't beat him, join him. You know, like Woodford, of all people. Then, of all things, the next year when I've gotten myself back to number four in the world, I lose to a guy I never heard of. The only time in my career I play a guy who, well, he ended up Harhouse being a pretty good player,
yes,
top 20 player and number one doubles player. But at the time I was like, how the hell could you lose to someone you don't even know? So that was, you know, extremely disappointing and embarrassing. And then, so it was gratifying. Stevie Ray Vaughan musically was always like a hero of mine, and the guy had died in a helicopter crash. And I remember, you know, perspective, I was like, you know, things, maybe they're not so bad for you, even though you bombed out in a way in the U.S. Open for, you know, four years in a row. And so all of a sudden it felt like, you know, I said, maybe you could just go out and play tennis. And that's sort of what happened. I was able to get a pretty good draw and get through some close matches, you know, beat Emilio Sanchez, who was the higher seed at the time, and David Wheaton in the quarters, you know, it was a favorable draw. So when I got to play Pete, who was 19 at the time, I said, okay, my time has come. You know, you got Agassi, who's 19 or 20, and you got Pete. And, you know, this should be doable. You know, I know he'd beaten Lendl in the quarters, who I wanted an opportunity to play against. But I said, maybe this is even better. You know, and I made a monumental blunder when I played Pete. I thought, like, let him beat himself and I'll play more conservative, just sort of not be as aggressive as I normally am, and let him just sort of beat himself. Well, that didn't happen. You know, he went out and started, you know, swinging away, and turns out this guy's not a bad player.
So you obviously didn't envision that he was going to become the all-time great that he did, and the candidate for greatest of all time at when you lost to him that day.
Well, I mean, at that time, I had hit with him a few years earlier. Paul Cohen had told me in 1989 when I was working with him that he said, look, he brought me a couple people. I got to hand it to him. He had Venus and Serena Williams, only like 7 and 8, and Pete Sampras, who at that time may have been 16 or 17. So I could see that this guy had a lot of ability. You know, you don't know when that's all going to come together, or if it's going to, you hope it doesn't come together against when you're playing him. And he's only 19, and I felt like the time was right for me. I didn't realize his game was so big at that stage already, that his serve was that big, that his forehand was that big. I thought he'd make a lot more mistakes and that he would not be able to handle the occasion. But boy, was I wrong.
Absolutely. Well, and John, so then, and I know you've more than conceded that point, and you've been a great admirer of Sampras, but it a couple of years later, your last Open in singles, and you lost to Courier, but you were the quintessential New Yorker, and you win the title 4 times, only Federer, Sampras, Connors winning it more. How do you feel about what you achieved at the Open, how you ended it there, and I mean, looking at it retrospectively, how happy are you with what you did at the Open?
Well, I'm very proud of what I did. I mean, I went out there. Listen, you know, Pete Sampras is an all-time great. Courier was number one in the world that time. The game, you know, my body wasn't quite what it was. I'd lost a little bit of speed, and it was extremely frustrating not to be able to sort of react the way I did before, because that's when I really needed it, against guys who were hitting it harder. And I would have loved to have been able to play against them had I been feeling that same way, but I just couldn't quite get there. And so the last 3 Opens I played, I lost to Sampras, Chang. The only time I ever lost to Chang was a 5-setter in the 91 Open. And then Courier, who at that time, you know, was, I think he was ranked number one in the world that year. So it wasn't that far away. I still felt like I was reasonably close. I'd been in the semis in Wimbledon, and I just felt like I just got out hit. And it was depressing. But it sort of felt like that's it. I just can't, you know, I'd sort of try to talk myself for whatever reasons for years that it hadn't happened. I just thought, you know, it's just not going to happen. So I'd rather go out with my head high. And I gave it my best shot. And there were some great runs and, you know, winning 3 in a row and 4 overall and being in, you know, 5 finals and being able to play at Forest Hills. I mean, I played my first doubles match. I played with Tony Palafox, my coach, and we played, of all people, Peter Fleming and Vitas Gerulaitis, of all the people in the draws. Like, how the hell does this happen? And then, so, you know, there was these incredible memories that happened. And because of, you know, when we were playing at the Open in 77, that's when Peter and I decided to start playing doubles. And so there was a lot of good things that happened from there, from even dating back to being a ball boy there, and my first tournament was at Forest Hills. Then I'm a ball boy. Then I play there. Then I'm at the U.S. Open. 15 minutes, I get to play at Flushing Meadows, for goodness sakes. 15 minutes from where I grew up and win it 4 times. So I still feel like I got a little goosebumps now.
Absolutely. John, the tennis world, we're celebrating the 50th anniversary this year. How would you assess your role in helping to raise the profile of the tournament as you look back over the course of your career? How proud are you of the role you played in sort of evoking so many emotions from the fans and being such a big part of this era?
Well, I've always felt proud that I would get people playing against me to, you know, try their hardest, because I sort of didn't want people to go out there and half-ass it. I hated that, and I hated it as a commentator. It ended up hurting me at times, because I'd sort of go after some guys and trash talk them a little bit, and then they'd go out and give that extra effort and it would cost me. But in a way, I was like, okay, you got to take the good with the bad. So I felt like there was an unbelievable energy in the 70s into the 80s that I was very, very happy and proud to be part of. I was you know, part of a contingent of guys that I think brought tennis up the excitement to a new era. And now sort of coming full circle over the course of the last 25 years, I guess call it sort of an ambassador of the game, be able to reflect more positively on my experiences and maybe people looking at me more positively when they understand maybe or think they know more about me. I think they do as a human being and what I represent and, you know, how much I care about the sport and want to see it succeed in the future and continue to try to do that. That's why I'm sitting and talking to you at my, you know, at my tennis academy. And I love, you know, I want to see a New Yorker again win the U.S. Open. You know, that would be the ultimate satisfaction to be part of giving more kids in New York City an opportunity to play this great game and to see it flourish once again and get that boost that I believe it deserves and needs.
John, how do you envision the next 50 years, you know, when we get to the 100th anniversary? What are your main hopes as you kind of gaze into the future for the Open and for the game?
My main hopes would be that more people, more kids out there have the opportunity to play this great game, that can afford to do it, have access to it, that we reach out more and try to make this game more for the masses. That's been my goal since the first time I played. I think it's, you know, still a significant problem. I think tennis is a great sport. It's a microcosm for your own life. It's a character builder. It gives you a reason, you know, even now at my age, just, you know, go at it and try to stay fit. And so there's so many positives to it that I would hate to see it become sort of that niche game that sometimes I'm concerned it will become. So I'm hopeful in the next 50 years that if we have the type of explosion we had sort of midway through, if I could be a tiny part of that, or whether I am or not, and it happens, that would be extremely satisfying to see the cool factor and the affordability factor come back into it.
John, 2017 was a tough year for you. You lost both of your parents in a short span. And how would you describe their respective roles in making you who you are and what they did to shape your career?
Well, you know, as a lot of people know, I mean, parents are the most important relationships you have in your life, I believe. And they're the ones that sort of get you to believe in yourself. And both my parents, especially my dad, when it came to tennis, you know, were always like, you can do it. You know, I believe in you, and, you know, no matter what. And that's extremely comforting. And then my mom always would say to me, she would only come to my matches when she thought I was going to lose, because she was afraid I was going to cry. So, you know, you want your mom there when you cry, when you're a kid. So she was always felt like she was there for me. And that was obviously important, as any kid could attest to. So, you know, the reason that I was able to sort of find from a kid in Douglas and Queens the ability to believe that I could go out there and potentially at one stage be the best in the world and win the U.S. Open on a number of occasions. Obviously, some of it I'd like to think is the person himself, myself, but the parents have a key role in keeping you believing and giving you the opportunity to do that. You know, at the time when I was growing up, I almost preferred in some ways playing some other sports, but it was always there for me. And it was pretty clear that this is the one that I was the best at and the most exceptional. And so that they were able to sort of keep perspective and sort of give me that sort of, well, look, if it doesn't work out, we want you to be a lawyer, doctor, go to a good school, but we believe you can do it. And so that was a great thing to have.
John, finally, the fans nowadays, you know, they see you and hear you so regularly on television as a commentator everywhere, but especially at the Open. And many, I know I myself, are struck by your genuine appreciation of the likes of Roger and Rafa and Novak and other leading players, and you always seem to look on the positive side of what they're doing, while some past champions seem a little less charitable toward the top players of today. You always seem to be singing their praises. How much longer, how do you talk about that part of yourself, and how much longer do you see yourself in that commentary chair?
Yeah, that's difficult to say, and you know, I don't necessarily have the final say in that, obviously, when you work for someone, but you know, I've been very fortunate to be able to express myself in a different way. And I think it's turned out to be sort of a win-win. I'd like to think for the people that listen as well as myself that, you know, they've seen a different side of me. They see that I know the game and they see that I care. And so that's been important. And when you're out playing regularly, and which I still like to do, and out close to it, you get an appreciation. You certainly understand more about how difficult it is to perform under those circumstances, how gratifying it is, but also how difficult. So that's allowed me to sort of marvel at what these guys, especially the three you mentioned, have been able to accomplish, because I've been there. I've been out in the court where I've laid an egg. I've been on the court when I've risen to the occasion. I know what the type of adrenaline rush you can get, the frustration that happens when it's not going your way, figuring out a way to turn it around, how proud you are as a human being, all the things that you go into trying to be the best you can be and just going out and competing as hard as you possibly can. So it's a great thing to be able to sit up in the booth. I mean, admittedly, you're being like a backseat driver, and I know, I tell the players, I know it's a lot easier what I do. I understand that. And the only thing I really get down on players is when they're not giving an effort. You know, besides that, I understand a lot, and I think they respect the fact that that's where it's coming from. It's coming from the heart, and it's coming from someone who cares.
John, thanks so much for taking the time to talk today. I enjoyed it immensely, and I hope you did as well, having the chance to relive it, as you said at the start.
You got it, Steve. Thanks a lot. It's fun.
Thanks for listening to Courtside, the official podcast of the U.S. Open. I'm Steve Flink. Qualifying week is upon us. We hope you enjoy the 2018 U.S. Open, and thank you for listening all year to our celebration of 50 years of the U.S. Open.